And the recording starts. Okay, so I'm just going to jump right into these. Not necessarily in any particular order of priority, but here's one from Jessica. Any thoughts on how near-death experiences relate to bardos? Yes, for sure. Lots of thoughts, Jessica. NDEs, well, the literature here is enormous. There's so much out there. And they relate principally to the inner dissolution. It gets a little technical here, but they principally relate in the Tibetan Buddhist cartography of the bardos, or three death bardos. The painful dying of bardo has eight stages, five stages connected to the death of the body, and then three stages connected to the death of confused samsaric consciousness. And so the near-death experiences, it's difficult to make complete correlations, what are called isomorphic correlations between one mapping system and the next. But when you read the NDE literature and you read that what takes place in the three stages of the inner dissolution, white appearance, red increase, black near attainment, boy, it sure does sound awful familiar. And just one thing, one of many things to say, people often in near-death experiences talk about going through a tunnel, heading towards white light. Well, this is completely correlative to what would be called a stage of white appearance, where what are called the bindus, the bindu that comes from your father. Again, it gets a little technical, but you ask. At the top of your head starts to descend through the central channel. The bindu is basically, you can really think of it as a drop of consciousness, white. And hey, what does that sound like? Sounds like white light going through a tunnel. This is a really, really big topic. There isn't any, that I'm aware of, any overt correlations in the literature. But if you study in particular the three stages of the inner dissolution, you will get a pretty interesting correlation between NDEs and the bardos. Once you transition through the final stage of stage eight and enter the luminous bardo dharmata, according to the Tibetans, that's irreversible. You're not coming back. It's no longer a near-death experience. It's a death experience. It's non-retrogressive, so to speak. So the only way, the only bardo NDEs really relate is the painful bardo of dying, and principally the three stages of the inner dissolution. So if you're on, Jessica, and want to say something or ask something more about that, more than welcome. Okay, from Jenny. Hi, Andrew. I've recently been dipping in and out of Nisargadatta's. Yeah, this is one of the great, great books. Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, classic text called I Am That. Amazing book. In this book, Nisargadatta frequently advises questioners to stay in the I am. Yeah, that's a classic Advaita Vedanta thing. Back to you. Out of curiosity, is there a practice akin to this in Buddhism? Any thoughts on the extent to which this practice might support lucid dreaming? Well, on how it might support lucid dreaming, it'll support lucid dreaming in the sense that lucidity is a code word for awareness. And if you can stay in this particular state of turiya, which is what he's pointing to, alluding to, the fourth, then this is not only supports lucid dreaming, it also supports yoga nidra, lucid sleep. But here's the deal. The Buddhists do not have an analog I am, because there is no I. And so this is where there's a big difference, at least in terms of nomenclature. When people like Rupa Spira, who I really appreciate, Ramana Maharshi, Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, and a bunch of other amazing teachers in the Advaita Vedanta tradition, they talk about I am. Well, the Buddhists would shred that. I mean, Nagarjuna would just take that to pieces and say, point to this I. When they talk about I am, they're talking in Buddhist languaging, that's the eighth consciousness. That's not turiya, that's not wisdom at all. That's just the basis of the confused samsaric mind. So in the classic usage of I am, there's nothing like this in Buddhism, because there is no I in Buddhism. That's completely taken apart. There is no self. However, and this is where you can get really interesting debates, if you look at perhaps the phenomenology of what's actually taking place, and I can't say exactly what Nisargadatta is experiencing when he talks about this, you can say, and David Loy makes an interesting argument in his book, Non-Duality in Buddhism and Beyond, where he compares that big S self, I am, of Vedanta with selflessness. with anatman. And so phenomenologically, they may be completely the same. In terms of nomenclature, the Buddhists would, there's nothing like this. But again, if you say phenomenologically, I am, if you're talking about Turiya, if you're talking about nature of mind, then that would be equivalent to Rigpa. That would be equivalent to resting in the nature of mind and non-duality. And parenthetically, this is exactly the type of thing that I'll be discussing with Bob Thurman in the program in Menla in September. So it's all about this topic. So again, if you're here and you want to come on and bat that around with me a little bit, more than welcome. The closest practice phenomenologically to this would be nature of mind practices, Mahamudra, Dzogchen, anything where you rest in the nature of reality, Rigpa. Okay. I'm currently enjoying listening to the audio version of your new book on reverse meditation. Oh, that's cool. Yep, there it is. Hey, what a surprise. I just happen to have a copy right here. Just wondering if you have any plans for a reverse meditation book club. Yeah, probably in about a year and a half as we go through our next book. We just finished the Dream Yoga book. We're about to start the Preparing to Die book, which is my biggest one. That's like a 400 plus pager. Since we meet twice a week on that, that's probably going to take about a year to get through. And then reverse meditation could well be the next book. So I really appreciate the gesture. Thank you for listening to the book. And the best place to be aware of this is on the Nightclub platform. This is where we have a book group. In fact, it alternates with what we're doing here. One week we're doing the Q&A like we're doing here. The next week we do behind the firewall, behind the paywall, the book study group with Nightclub. And so that, when we do it, would be in the under the umbrella of Nightclub. Okay. Hi, Andrew. You have said that several, this is from Amanda. You have said that several short, sharp periods of meditation during the day may be effective. Absolutely, positively effective. This is a classic, again, Mahamudra Dzogchen practice. Short sessions repeated often are fantastically efficacious. And in fact, in terms of mixing meditation with life, with post-meditation, I would say they're more effective. Back to you. How long should they be to facilitate neuroplasticity? That's a really great question. This is a question to ask Richie Davidson and all the other neuroscientists, Antoine Lutz, people who are studying this sort of thing. I don't know if in the literature they've studied this sort of thing. To the best of my ability, durations of around 10 minutes or so, but again, I'm shooting from the hip here. I can't speak with complete authority. Really, these short micro instances of opening, a short one breath meditation, or even just flashing, does that facilitate neuroplasticity? Oh, no doubt, no doubt. Are there studies on this? I don't know, I don't think so. Okay, back to you. This would presumably be shamatha vipassana. Well, yes, it would be the union of insight and stability, shamatha vipassana. During metta and tonglen meditations, the mind is more busy. So would this affect neuroplasticity, or is the outcome the same? Well, it depends on what kind of outcome you're talking about. Tonglen and metta are definitely working with neuroplasticity. Absolutely, every meditation, right? What you do with your mind changes your brain. Every practice is going to be working with changing your brain via neuroplasticity. The duration of things like Tonglen and Metta, again, I don't know. The neuroscience around this, there's like 8,000 studies, right? I'm familiar with a couple hundred max. And there's so much stuff coming out so quickly, I don't know what's actually happening. I used to get a weekly update. I don't get it anymore because it's just so overwhelming, of the 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 studies coming out every month on this stuff. And some of these studies, by the way, are less than ideal. They're kind of pretty sloppy study design and stuff like that. So I'm just not in the weeds enough. This is where you need to ask these questions, Amanda. It's a good question to the neuroscientists who are actually studying this. Amishi Jha, there's a bunch of people who do it. Okay, could I post the article on Yoga Nidra? Yes, I just need to find it. And the avalanche that is my inbox. So pardon me, that's something I just have to dig up. At the end of the Dream Yoga book club, in the section about humor, you said you would ask Alyssa to post some jokes. Did I say that? I don't remember that. I can't make a promise on that one. because my jokes are so bad, right? Okay, and so here's a couple other questions. Here's some longer ones. Okay, well, let me get this one first. I'm sorry. So here's from Tim, a little bit shorter. I have been pondering a question for a while. I understand and can accept the concept that there is a level of, quote, pure mind, luminosity, consciousness, or total awareness, end quote, from which everything arises. It's not just from which everything arises, Tim. It's also out of which everything is made. So it just doesn't arise. If it just arises from that, that will imply a subtle cosmological dualism. We want to avoid that, even though I understand the nature of your question. But it just doesn't arise from it. It arises as it. And that's a huge difference. Very important. Back to you. That makes sense to me. If this is true, however, then why do we perceive such a diversity of separate beings, things, and thoughts as our life experience? How and why is there such a perception when unity is the true reality? Could you share some ideas and thoughts? Absolutely. Yes, there are so many ways to talk about this. The illusion of separation is basically brought about by ignorance, ma-rigpa. This is depending on the school. Every tradition will have its rendering of what creates the illusion of separateness, the illusion of diversity, the illusion of duality, the illusion of solid, lasting, and independent. And so I riff on this. You ask, are there books that deal with this issue? Yeah, my book, Dreams of Light, we talk about this in to some degree. But here's what's interesting around this one. Again, it's a really great question. I like what my friend Bernardo Kestrup has to say about this when he talks about the three principal ways philosophically of looking at the arising of the phenomenal world, mind, and reality, and the problems associated with each one. So very briefly, if everything arises from matter, which of course it doesn't, then you have the hard problem of consciousness, which will never be solved because it's a false problem. You have what's called panpsychism, which is then you have the pan, then you have the what's called the combination problem. If everything is has a prehension or a proto-consciousness going down to the atomic level, then how do those proto-consciousnesses come together to create what we know as our awareness? So there you have the combination problem. The latter is the one that has the most explanatory power and the one that Bernardo riffs on quite beautifully. And this is the idealistic approach. Reality is in fact made of the nature of mind, as you put it, pure mind, luminosity, consciousness, total awareness, all the different terms. Then you have what's the challenge of what's called the decombination problem. If everything is in fact unity, where do we get the illusion of separation? And what he talks about here, and listen, I recommend him, you listen to my two podcast interviews with him on Edge of Mind, where we talk about this a lot because I press him on this issue. He talks about the issue of dissociation, dissociative alters, that we are each of us dissociative alters. Just like he has this really great analogy, it's very powerful, using dissociative identity disorder, formerly called multiple personality disorder, where even the mind of one being, so analogically think of one person who has one mind stream, and that person can have multiples, a number of dissociative alters within the same mind stream that are completely separate from each other, even in one mind. And he says this is a powerful analog to what happens with mind at large, the mind of the cosmos, and that we, you, me, I, everybody listening here, we are analogous to these dissociative alters. We are a dissociative alter in the mind of God, in the mind at large, whatever term you want to append. And so he has this wonderful analogy of a whirlpool, you know, a stream, stream of mind, stream of awareness, and then a highly kind of self-referential, contracting kind of whirlpool temporarily localizes the water around a particular space-time coordinate, locus of identity. And then we say there's the whirlpool, seemingly separate from the stream. Well, of course, that's not separate. It's just temporarily localized. And so what happens again, parenthetically, when we die? Well, just to throw that into the mix, the dissociation, that's, death is the end of the dissociation. Meditation is the end of the dissociation. Dropping into deep dreamless sleep is the end of the dissociation. And actually, moment to moment to moment, the dissociation takes place in lightning fast episodes every time we contract back onto self, which happens all the bloody time. So in addition to my book, Dreams of Light, where I riff on this, Bernardo really rolls with this. I might recommend probably his most accessible book. He has 11 of them out now, called Why Materialism is Baloney, and a great cover. I mean, great title, the cover of which is in fact a whirlpool. So a really great big question, but that's where I would roll with this one, okay? Now, these next couple of these next questions, I hope that people are here because I literally do not understand these questions. So I'm gonna start this question, and if John is here, J-O-M, and can come on and explain this question to me, I can run with it, but I'll read the first sentence or two and I'll tell you why I just don't understand what you're saying. Ideas have been coming to me recently about a community which exists across consciousness where lucid dreamers can meet in a sort of in-person in-dream conference where the participants meet in waking and in sleeping through the internet, in-person and lucid dreaming to study, learn, and share techniques for developing a practice in yogas of dream and sleep and bardo. Fantastic. And then the question goes on, but I'm not going to read it any further because if I don't understand the first part, it doesn't make any difference if I read the rest of it. I don't know from what you're saying here, and I've read this several times. Are you talking about a physical gathering? Are you talking about a physical conference, a mutuality of dreaming and cognitive space? Are you talking about a juxtaposition between dream space and physical space? If you're here and can come on and explain your question, I can try to address it. Otherwise, I apologize. I don't understand the way you have this worded. I don't know what you're saying. Sorry. But if you're here, I'm happy to run with it. In the meantime, here's another one I hate to say. I'll start this. I think this is from Patrick. This sounds to be, there's some typos in here, some missing words. And again, because of that, I don't understand what you want me to address. I recently was able to my brother's two young daughters for the first time. Okay. Do you mean I was recently able to be with my two brothers and their two daughters for the first time? Is that what you mean to say? If you did, you didn't write that. Sorry. And then there's this long riff in here. Patrick, if you're here and want to come on, you can help me. Same thing. This long riff about this beautiful experience that you had. And then something about, is there something I can say about this experience? Well, if you're here and can help me understand the experience, maybe I can say something about it. But because of the missing words, I don't want to just project and impute what I think you're saying. So Patrick, if you're here and can explain it, I'm happy to do my best taking a shot at it. But basically from what you're saying, I don't know what to say. Sorry. Okay. And then last one here, and then I'll open it up. This is from Penny. Okay. Hi, I'm so excited to be here, having just discovered you through the fascinating 10% Happier interview with Dan Harris. Thank you for listening to that. I really like Dan. I think he's awesome. I've been looking for answers to my nightly nightmares for years. Oh yeah, okay. I used to be a lucid dreamer and remember many recurrent dreams from my lifetime. In my most recent nightmare, I remember that I'd volunteered to look after a toddler. Yeah, and then you go on, Penny, again, if you're here, these questions are, they're wonderful, they're poignant. But I'm not sure what you want me to say with this. You're sharing a nightmare. I don't do dream interpretation. If you're here and you're asking for like, what does this nightmare mean? I don't work in that world. It's not to say that it's not important. It's fantastically important. Dream interpretation is great. But it's something I just don't do because it just doesn't seem like it's appropriate for me. I mean, who am I to interpret your dreams for you? I might recommend if you have nightmares, looking at the work of Claire Johnson, in particular her book, The Art of Transforming Nightmares, I believe it's called. She's the queen on this topic. And so the rest of your question, again, if you're here, please come on. If you want to say something about it, we can talk about it. But I generally don't do dream interpretation because as important as it is, and I personally work with it in my dreams all the time. But in a public setting, I don't really do that. I'm not, that's just not my thing. I do more lucid dreaming, dream yoga, which doesn't really have anything to do with dream interpretation. Again, it doesn't dismiss the validity of working with dreams in that capacity. It's great. But lucid dreaming, dream yoga, liminal dreaming, sleep yoga, just doesn't roll with this kind of interpretive end. And so I apologize for these three bigger questions from Penny, from Patrick, and from John. John and Patrick's, I just literally didn't understand. So I apologize. If you're here, please come on, help me understand it. And then Penny, I apologize, but I just don't do dream interpretation. I hope you understand. Okay. So, hey, I got about 60%. I apologize for these longer ones. They're wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing these. This is where, if you're here, want to come on, reinstate what you sent to me and want to talk about it, I am all here to talk to you about it. Okay. So in the meantime, if there is, I saw a hand pop up and then I saw it disappear. Yeah. So Meredith, fire away. I'm going to look in the chat column as well. But in the meantime, Meredith, help yourself. Hi.
I was a student of Sogyal Rinpoche's for many years.
Wonderful.
And during two retreats, he mentioned very briefly that, and this was with regard to Guru Yoga based on Padmasambhava, that if one did not have sufficient devotion, sufficiently developed devotion, when one passed away, even though one aspired to go to the pure realm of Padmasambhava, one could be instead turned into a Rakshasa. And he mentioned it twice. And I asked all, you know, I couldn't ever speak to him directly. I asked his people and, you know, everybody sort of just fluffed it off. And I was wondering if you had heard anything about that, because and that's really quite an important question if one is to base Guru Yoga on Padmasambhava.
Well, let me ask. Yeah, that's very
and interesting. I realize that I'm conceptualizing too much, but it's kind of an important.
No. You're articulate. Don't confuse articulation with conceptualization. You're doing a great job. Okay. But let me ask you this. Are you wanting an answer? And then I can address what you're saying. Are you wanting an answer because you're interested in going to Padmasambhava's copper-colored mountain when you die? Or are you interested because you want to work with guru devotion and mix your mind with his while you're still alive, or both?
No, it would probably be both. But if I'm to, you know, if he is the guru, and if that is the center of my practice, then it's really kind of important to know, you know, because who am I to have that kind of that level of devotion? I just don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, these are interesting questions, and they're a little bit tricky because, you know, when you get into this level of Vajrayana Tantra and you start worrying about worrying, you start working with the most important ingredient of Tantra, which is, in fact, devotion and Guru Yoga. I mean, Kenzi Rinpoche said everything in the Vajrayana basically is to cultivate devotion. Guru Yoga is basically the center of the Tantric mandala. And so you're right to work with a deep understanding of that principle. But the trick here is, you know, who am I to say anything about what Sogyal Rinpoche is professing around this? I'm in no position to either contest what he's saying or somehow, you know, challenge it. It's also, I'm curious, did he say this to you privately, or did he say it to you in a kind of a public setting, or was it heard in a public setting?
He said it both times in a public setting. It was during retreat at Larabling. Twice he mentioned it. And I would also just like to know the historical, you know, the actual situation in which this occurs. You know, I mean, is there some way I can avoid it? When did this arise? Have you ever heard of this?
Yes, I have. And so when you say avoid it, you're saying what? Avoiding being born as a Rakshasa in the copper-colored mountain?
Well, that would be nice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's one way to work your way around this is, and again, I'm just going to tell you what comes to my mind. I'm not in any way challenging anything that someone like Rinpoche would be saying. Is you could either augment or replace these aspirations for rebirth with a Pure Land that is much more accessible, like Devachan Sukhavati. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was created and designed to have the visa, the easiest visa requirements, right? And so when you start to play around, I have heard what he is saying, I have heard it before. When you start playing around with Copper Color Mountain rebirth and that sort of thing, this is full-blown tantric Pure Land. The minute you start playing around with that, it is filled with some of these kind of caveats and some of these perils that, mm-hmm. that is part of the literature. I have heard that before. Mm-hmm. So I would centrifuge out two things. First of all, personally, what I would do, if rebirth into a Pure Land is your aspiration, again, this is just me, take it or leave it, I would perhaps transition towards aspirations and prayers and practices that are associated with Dewachen and Amitabha's Pure Land. In terms of the devotion issue altogether, I mean, if you have a deep, heartfelt connection to Guru Rinpoche, and probably starting with Sogyal Rinpoche, you did because he was colossus in that tradition, mm-hmm. then you can work with developing this through the Seven Line Supplication, through there are guru yogas associated with him. I did it in my 3-year retreat. We spent 3 months doing these devotional practices around mm-hmm. Padmasambhava. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And so if you have the capacity to do those guru yogas and they really speak to you, then I would say put every ounce of your energy and heart into that. Mm-hmm. And then maybe just let the comments around the Pure Land, just set them aside. So you don't have to worry about that particular deleterious consequence. So I say all of this with tremendous hesitation and reservation, because this is the type of question that is really best addressed either towards a teacher, of course, he's no longer with us in human form, or with someone in that lineage, someone who maybe is still associated with Rigpa that can guide you more explicitly. So I'm very cautious mm-hmm. to kind of dole out these ivory tower sound bites without being firmly ensconced and embedded in the tradition that you were trained in. So I think you can understand, especially when it comes to tantric stuff and these types of statements from a teacher, I'm very respectful. I want to really be careful of what I say and basically speak based on my experience as a representative of the tradition as I've come to understand it. So I'm not sure how satisfactory that is, but I get very nervous when I...
I can understand that. Just one quick question. I have also heard that Sukhava tea is only for men.
You know, that's ridiculous.
Okay.
Again, I'm not saying that from you. That is so totally untrue. And I have tracked this one down. It's gender neutral. This is part of the patriarchy.
Okay.
Don't get me going on this. I really get irritated with this. The patriarchal BS around some of the stuff. This is actually, I'm going to say this very briefly, and again, with a little bit of reservation, but I was inspired by what I heard from Lama Paldin, you know, who the nun who spent 12 years in retreat, remember?
Yes.
She talks about this quite rigorously and directly, and I really appreciate it, where she says, you know, these rules and these things and the stuff that come, even the sutras that were written down, where did all this stuff come from? It came from men. It came from a patriarchal tradition that really started downloading all these sorts of things that I mean, this is where you have to filter out states of consciousness versus structures of consciousness. Mm. I'm happy to run with this. It's a really important, super big topic where there's a difference between waking up and growing up. But in short, I've tracked this one down myself because I teach on the Pure Lands. I've heard this, I can't tell you how many times, and I've tracked it down. I've asked teachers. It's just wrong. You know, you might find some commentary, some Shastra that says it's only for women. No, it's gender neutral. And so that one I can say with a fair amount of authority, whoever said that is just wrong.
I guess we're all gender neutral anyway, in the ultimate.
Well, exactly. In the ultimate sense, that's exactly right. There is no gender, there's no sexuality. And interesting, parenthetically enough, this is kind of playful. This is perhaps one reason why Sukhavati is called the land of great bliss and there's no suffering, because you don't have to deal with this whole sexuality thing. That in itself is somewhat interesting to me. But in terms of the tradition, the core sutras that talk about this and the translations, and here's the other thing, even with the translations, I work with a ton of translators, I go to conferences, you can get 10 different translators looking at the exact same text, and they are gonna translate these things in terms based on their developmental structures, whether they know it or not. And so if they bring some of these patriarchal predispositions, I mean, talk about lost in translation. So this one I can speak with some authority on, and it really gets my goat, the whole patriarchal thing. The other stuff, I think you can hopefully appreciate, I get very hesitant to speak with any authority about such deep, beautiful, profound topics. And so if you can find someone from RCPA, if Christine Longacre is still around, some of the other people in RCPA, for clarity on this, I might go there, but I get really leery to stay from speak something from the outside about traditional viewpoints there.
Well, I really thank you, because this is one of those questions I thought, well, I'll just sit with it and it'll answer itself. But it's been 10 years. And so I'm you're the first one who came up, who gave me an answer at all. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah. And I hope you understand my hesitation to go in there and say, oh, this is the way it is. This is what you should do. You know, these I've heard one teacher say within a few minutes to basically the same question coming from different people, two completely different answers. You probably have seen this. Mm-hmm. And so these types of responses mm-hmm. are highly situational, which is why they're so powerful when they're given in a public setting. It really is this kind of like, you had to be there. Mm. And so sometimes a teacher will say one thing to one person and they'll say something completely different to the same question to somebody else. And so how do you roll with that? And how do I come in as a third party from the outside and come in with any authority?
I don't want to take up much time, but I just wanted to know if you had any place I could read this in either sadhana or books on Guru Rinpoche written by Yeshe Shogo. I don't know, but where can I go to actually read about this? Would you know?
About the whole Rakshasa issue?
Yes.
That's a really great question. If you can ping your address, send it either to me at andrew@andrewhalachek.com. I can, several titles come to mind, but I can't say with 100% authority that they're there. I can also ask some high-level translators who roll in this world that might be able to help me. But off the top of my head, I don't want to just guess. There's a number of texts that come to mind where it could be.
Okay.
I've definitely read what you're talking about. I have read that.
Okay.
So that part is not you.
Thank you.
Welcome. Okay. Is it Dominica?
Yeah. Hi. Thanks so much. So I was hoping to get your thoughts a little bit on dream yoga practice. Okay. I have a particularly poor aptitude, I think, for lucid dreaming. Seems like most people, if you ask them if they've ever had a lucid dream in their life, you know, they've had at least one. I had never had one spontaneously. And last fall, I decided that I wanted to make a really solid effort of that practice for spiritual purposes. So probably about September, October, I started working with some different methods. Didn't have any success. Earlier this spring, maybe March or so, I got your audiobook, your Dream Yoga audiobook. I'm working through the physical book right now, which has more detail, but I've probably listened to the audiobook like 6 times. Nice. And started working with a little bit different of an approach after listening through your program. I really liked what you said about the sort of fable or parable about the man digging wells and only digging a little ways down and then going over to, and I think that's what I've been doing. And gotcha. So I got more resolute with the mild method. And within a week, I actually had my first real bona fide lucid dream.
Excellent.
That was several months ago. And I've not had another one yet. Sure. Admittedly, as I know you love to mention about how dream yoga practice is an advanced practice, partly because you have to be your own meditation instructor. You really have to be self-motivated, and that self-motivation can be difficult when you're not seeing. I'm not even just looking for instant results. I'm looking for any results. Okay. And you know, when I say I have a particularly low aptitude, I mean, I've been a mindfulness meditator for 20 years and I never had one spontaneously, even after 6 months of trying to some degree. I didn't have one. And it just, now I feel like, oh, when I listened to your audiobook and then had one after a week, that was almost just like beginner's luck, because I have yet to strike gold again. And so I'm very committed to this as a long-term practice. And I'm sure I will have another one eventually. But, you know, I thought it doesn't hurt to throw it out there and kind of just get your thoughts on, you know, someone who's already a mindfulness meditator, long history in the Dharma, but yet has such a poor aptitude for this. Kind of remedial.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, a couple of things. First of all, this is incredibly common. And I, not in any way to dismiss any of what you're saying, this is probably the single most, not probably, definitely the single most common issue challenge around lucid dreaming and dream yoga. And so there are a number of things to say here. One is, you may be having these dreams and not even be aware of them. So there's a difference between what's called access and phenomenal consciousness. You can absolutely positively, even though it seems to be a little bit more the exception than the rule, but I also can't say that with complete authority, that people can have lucid dreams. They just don't bring them. That's the phenomenal part, but they don't bring them into access consciousness. So they don't recall them. That's one thing. But with that said, the fact that you haven't had overt access lucid dreams, again, is super common. So a couple of things. One is, something's happening whether you know it or not. And so the analogy I use is, imagine a big vat of cold water. Depending on how big the vat is and how cold the water is, that represents your non-lucid habits, right? I mean, fundamentally, we've been practicing non-lucidity from the minute we were born, pretty much. And if you believe in things like rebirth, you've been practicing non-lucidity unwittingly from beginningless time. And so this is why we all bear the fruits of our unconscious non-lucid practice. We're always meditating. We're always becoming familiar with either lucidity or non-lucidity, awareness or non-awareness. And so we see the fruits of our efforts in our dreams. That's why the moniker for dream yoga is the measure of the path. But what's happening is, if you understand, especially like the Yogacara, I'm not sure which tradition you're studying, but if you understand a little bit about the Yogacara, you might want to look at Thich Nhat Hanh's beautiful book, Understanding Our Mind, where he talks really beautiful about this. This is important to understand, because to cut to the quick, you put that cold water in a big vat on a stove. Well, depending on how big it is, depending on how cold it is, and how much heat you have on, energy is being put into the system. There is something happening. It's just happening below the radar. You are warming up whether you know it or not. And so understanding that that's part of what's going on, even if you haven't had overt, you haven't come to a boil consistently yet, the energy is being distributed into the system. So I'm curious if you've noticed perhaps even increase in dream recall, increase in clarity of dreams, increase in stability of dreams. Have you noticed any of these sorts of things in your kind of dream history?
There definitely hasn't been a steady trend in any direction. It's pretty up and down over the course of the past. I mean, now it's been more than 6 months since I started this. My dream recall fluctuates between remembering 3 dreams a night with pretty good detail to waking up, so, you know, feeling really fuzzy headed and not remembering any. And it's been, you know, up and down over time. In general, historically, throughout my life, I've had a pretty vivid dream life and pretty good dream recall, I think, probably compared to the average person. If I might say one other thing, one thing that I notice in terms of patterns of what I experience in dreams, one thing that makes it a little bit difficult to gain lucidity, to have that aha moment, is that not a lot happens in my dreams, at least the dreams I recall, that is categorically different from anything that could happen in real life. My dreams are pretty ordinary, and it's relatively uncommon that anything happens in them that, you know, like flying or something really bizarre. And it's very typical in dreams that I'm experiencing some kind of a strong emotion or interacting with other people. And I definitely find it a lot harder. I suspect I'm not alone in this. It's a lot harder to maintain when awake, a spacious awareness of, say, like illusory form, when engaging with another person. It's easier to remember that, oh, this is all like a dream, when I'm kind of just in my own bubble. So direct interaction or strong emotion seems to really cloud that.
That's also super classic. That's absolutely classic. And so, I mean, so there's so much to say here, but a couple of things for take home messages. One is, this is a reason why I retrofitted and now emphasize more and more the practice of liminal dreaming, because liminal dreaming is a lucid sleep onset practice. In other words, it greases the skids for lucid dreaming, but it's also a practice in its own right. And so this is that wonderful pre and post dream state, hypnagogic-hypnopompic, where you can work with exploring your mind as it transitions from the waking state to the dream state. And so I might encourage that you backpedal a little bit and spend more time working with liminal principles. You might look at the interview I did. I'm not sure it's on Edge of Mind platform, but I know it's in the nightclub with Jennifer Dumpert, D-U-M-P-E-R-T. She wrote a book by that title called Liminal Dreaming. You might want to take a really close look at that. She also brings in some subtle principles from Yoga Nidra, because this is something that anybody can do every single night when they go to sleep. And you start to notice these little micro lucid dreamlets taking place. And you can start to develop some real facility and proficiency in the liminal space. That's huge. So in and of itself, it's a marvelous practice. And then as a lucid sleep onset practice preparatory for lucid dreaming, it's great. The other thing is, it's exactly why I wrote the second of my three books on my dream yoga, lucid dreaming trilogy, the Dreams of Light book that I mentioned earlier. That book was explicitly written for people who don't have facility with lucidity at night. They work with the daytime correlate, which is, like you mentioned, the practice of illusory form. I mean, illusory form is the main practice. Dream yoga is a subset of illusory form. And so, yes, it's great to continue to put energy into the system, keep going. But you can also emphasize a little bit more of the diurnal practice of illusory form and the different stages associated with that. And so the book, Dreams of Light, is all about this. And so you might find, when you're working with that at a deep level, along with liminal dreaming, you may actually find somewhat magically that your lucid dreams start to warm up and start to pop a little bit more. So this is, you know, I'm not sure if you're a nightclub member, but we started a nightclub first time I've said this, largely for exactly this type of support, so that you're not alone, you're with a community, you listen to all these, got like 50, 60 webinars on there, interviews with dozens of people, 400 hours of content there, and a number of webinars specifically devoted to exactly these topics. So I might refer you to that if you haven't explored that platform. There's a ton out there. But in short, it's super common. What you're saying is actually more common. It's just almost like the rule. And so this is what, like you mentioned earlier, lucid dreaming is advanced. One reason it's considered advanced is because advanced practitioners never give up. You just keep going, not too tight, not too loose. So, you know, if you try too hard, you know, it's like lucid dreaming on one level plays by the same rules as conventional causality, but it also applies, it has its own rules. And it's sometimes I like to think of it these days as like romance. You know, you're romancing a particular quality of your mind. And if you come on, you know, like really heavy bulldozing, too tight, too direct, I mean, if somebody was hitting on you like that, you would run, right? And so there's something about this not too tight, not too loose, where, and this is part of the frustration and part of the elegance, where you want to romance the lucid qualities of your mind, and you have to see how the mind works. It's very mercurial. It doesn't play by standard rules. Sometimes you'll be trying, you give up, and then all of a sudden you have the dream because you've been trying too hard. And so this is part of what makes this so challenging, frustrating, and also rewarding. And so when you have a more light, playful attitude that every night you're going to play with the liminal thing, every night you're going to insert some energy, you're going to try, but you're not going to try too hard. And then eventually, you know, you know how to flirt with this quality of your being, and it starts to click with you a little bit more. But with that said, continue to read the books, classic instructions, take the courses when you can, when they're offered by really gifted people. Charlie Morley is one, Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche is one. You know, he's done some really beautiful things. I roll a little bit in this world. And then you just keep going. Supplement that with liminal dreaming, supplement that with the daytime practice of illusory form. Kind of diversify your portfolio. Don't put it all in one market, right? Just diversify. And then you may find, because lucidity is a dependently originated phenomena, it doesn't abide by single action bias, these targets of like one particular technique. It's multifactorial. And therefore, diversifying your portfolio, not only is it more enjoyable, more playful, but it's more fruitional. So you might want to just relax, open the aperture a little bit, and work with some of these other approaches. Okay? Yeah, cool. Thank you so much. Good question. Really good one. Okay, Hannah, fire away. In the meantime, I'm going to look to see if I'm missing anything here.
Okay. Yeah, I have a question about some of the early history of Tibetan Buddhism. Okay. And how when... Pardon?
I said, okay.
Oh, okay. Because I know the Bon tradition was in Tibet when Buddhism came to Tibet.
Yeah, it's pre-existing, correct.
And so I'm curious about what influences the Bon had, and yes, what is the current state of the Bon? And because I only hear bits and pieces, and I never really get much of more information.
Yeah, this is a big, big, rich, wonderful topic. It is called Bön because that's Umla, so it's Bön.
Okay.
It is the pre-existing indigenous and somewhat shamanic animistic tradition of Tibet. And it had a monumental influence on Tibet, on Buddhism as it migrated from the subcontinent of India into the tantric milieu. One of the principal reasons Tantra has, I can't say this exclusively because a lot of this was actually influenced by Hindu Tantra, but a lot of the shamanistic, animistic, magical, mystical aspects of it, in fact, were adapting to the cultural milieu, like water flowing into a different container. You travel throughout Asia, and it's amazing how different Buddhism is from China, Japan, Mongolia, Tibet, Malaysia. It's really fascinating to see how the cultural container worked with the transplantation of this tradition. So there's a great deal to say here. I'll pause for a second to see if you want to take me in a particular direction. I might recommend you read, the literature here is quite replete, but I like my friend Reggie Ray's book, Indestructible Truth, and also Secrets of the Vajra World. These two volumes have a tremendous amount to say about the transplantation of Buddhism from India into Tibet. There's also a book by, I think, John Powers. I can't remember the exact title. There's a lot out there these days. So if there's something a little bit specific you want me to address, the cross-pollination between these two traditions is amazing.
Yeah.
Why it's so great to read Tenzin Wangyal's work, Dan Brown, who recently passed, and now that mantle has been transferred to a dear friend of mine, Dustin DePerna. Dan was an incredibly facile translator, scholar, practitioner in both classic Tibetan and Bön Buddhism. And so there's a tremendous amount that these traditions worked off of each other. And so they're extraordinarily rich. The Dalai Lama embraces the Bön Buddhism as if it was part of the family. So I'm not sure where else to run with this. It's such a wonderful big topic, but that's where I might go for some resources and some exploration.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, welcome. Let me get, before I get to Dr. J here, let me get this one question for Andrew. Is chi the same as prana? Depends on who you ask. Sometimes chi, and then also chi as in qigong, not just the Chinese chi of Chinese medicine, it's associated synonymously with prana. Others would say that prana, lung, is actually more subtle than qi. So that question depends on who you ask. More or less, very, very similar, but I wouldn't say they're synonymous. Due to the practices I've been engaged in, my awareness of my body has increased greatly. Good for you. Fantastic. I can feel qi that they say in yoga class, in yoga circles, as what can be felt in the hand. I feel that all over my body. Wonderful, through your body. Is this the experience of the subtle body? Yes, it's an experience of the anatomical subtle body. A subtle body is another, like prana and chi itself, subtle body is a multivalent term, depending on how you define it. I mean, basically, subtle body can be anything that exists from fully de-reified formlessness to fully reified form. That massive intermediate bandwidth between those two can be appended the label subtle. And so you have subtle body phenomenologically, that's thoughts, emotions, and the like. Then you have subtle body anatomically and physiologically. And you're talking a little bit about both. You're talking about how this relates to your physical body, and you're also talking about how it relates to you phenomenologically as something you perceive and feel. So you're talking about both. How can I take advantage of this awareness in Mahamudra meditation? Okay. For example, subtle body is not talked about very much. Actually, it is. Most of the work is at the level of thoughts. Well, yes, in the causal vehicles. There's a lot in the Mahamudra tradition. I might recommend, this question is anonymous, so I don't know who's asking it. I might recommend you look at the 4 or 5 books by Reggie Ray. Touching Enlightenment is his first big one on it. I highly recommend it. He talks a ton about this. And then he has 4 other books. I can't remember all the titles, but Dr. Reginald Ray, he's also the gentleman I talked about earlier that wrote the 2 books on Indestructible Truth, The Secrets of the Vajra World. His riffs on the subtle body here are great. The other person who actually works with this a lot is Mingje Rinpoche. In fact, he just did a program for Tergar, T-E-R-G-A-R. You might be able to track it down on their online site. I'm not entirely sure if it's still available, but maybe. He gave a seminar precisely on this. Anything in the inner yogas is part of Mahamudra. It's part of the Tantra. And this is talked about a ton. It actually constitutes, by some accounts, 1/3 of tantric teachings and practices. So subtle body is actually talked about a lot. Deeper divers, read The Profound Inner Principles by Rongjung Dorje, translated by my dear friend Elizabeth Callahan. That's the Bible here. It's one of the 3 most important books in all of Vajrayana Buddhism. So for starters, I recommend Reggie's book, Touching Enlightenment, and then the 3 others that came after that. They're all really quite helpful because Reggie does a kind of a cultural translation of subtle body processes and practices for the Western world, and he's quite skillful at it. So there's a lot there. The literature is actually quite replete. Tsogyen Rinpoche is another one, T-S-O-G-N-Y-I. He's another one who teaches with some regularity about subtle body processes. So it's actually there. In the dream yoga literature, it's really big deal. The inner yogas are a really big deal. So that's also in that literature as well. Okay, so see if there's anything else before I get to Dr. J. Yeah, what is Rakshasa? Cannibal demons. That's why you don't want to be born as a Rakshasa, right? Yes, it's a form of evil spirit. You could definitely say that. Yeah, that's why I didn't want to mention anything, because I didn't want to give you nightmares tonight. Yeah, and Barry, to Domenica, galantamine. Read what Barry has written here. He's really savvy with this stuff. He's a solid nightclub member. And what he's talking about here is a great way to work with bumping up lucidity, Domenica. Galantamine is super effective. Galantamine can join with the wake to back method, can join with the mile technique. Boy, that's where I would put my bang for the buck. Okay. Yeah, a bunch of stuff on galantamine. I'm going to pass on that for now. Okay, so Dr. J, and then if there's anybody else, we usually run about the hour mark, so we're getting towards that mark, but fire away, Dr. J.
Well, I got a couple questions, but let's address the one we just talked about, galantamine.
Okay.
You know, galantamine, I've been watching your program for months, if not years, and I went out and, you know, to health food store and got galantamine. Yeah. And I tried it. It never had even the slightest effect.
Right. For some people, correct.
And then, much to my surprise, I found out a couple months ago. Remember, these are health food stores, and it's not FDA approved.
It's a completely unregulated industry.
Yes, yeah, so you don't know. But much to my surprise, I found out 2 months ago that there is a fully FDA-approved form of galantamine. It's called galantamine hydrobromide, and it's been around for a long, long time. And when you read what the indications are for, it says galantamine should be used for people who are having early dementia or early memory problems.
Totally, 100%. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Well, have you known about that?
I did. Yep. That's where I think it comes up under another or a couple of other trade names as well. It's used for dementia, memory loss, and the like. It's a nootropic, and so it has been in the prescription categories. I think Schedule 3 probably.
It's completely on schedule. No.
I thought you said it was prescription. What you're talking about?
Yeah, prescription drugs are divided into scheduled drugs. Like you need an FDA license, and unscheduled drugs, like diuretics, stuff like that. It's a non-scheduled drug. You don't need a DEA license for, I guess you would say, narcotics.
Look deeper, because if you look, I think it's called reserpine. There's a couple others that are prescription strength. I know that for a fact, but I don't remember the names because I don't work in that world anymore. But bottom line is, yes, it's been around for a while in the medical community, used for cognitive decline, for memory loss, for dementia and the like. Indeed. And then you have like what you're talking about, the unregulated over-the-counter stuff where you never know what you're getting.
Exactly.
You have no idea. And so for some people, galantamine works. It works really well for me. For other people, it does absolutely nothing. And there's other stuff out there now. Some people have been approached me with a Zoroastrian blend, which I'm going to be exploring. They're going to send me some of that. And I'm going to say, yeah, I'm willing to try whatever, as long as it's not like going to fry my brain, which it might. But there are, read David J. Brown's book, Dreaming Wide Awake. He has two really rich chapters on all the supplements around this, of which there are a ton. Thomas Yushak wrote a book. He's a mysterious kind of guy, disappeared. A book called Advanced Lucid Dreaming. And he has all this. It's not studied. It's all anecdotal stuff. The scientists really quiver. They have a real issue with this kind of stuff. But he also riffs on a bunch of these kind of agents that can be used. They have a place for sure. I use galantamine sparingly, but those of you who attend my programs, signed with a waiver, I do explore it in my dream yoga programs, because I personally have had tremendous luck with galantamine. This stuff really works. And studies have shown that it works. Studies by Benjamin Baird, Stephen LaBerge, Ryan Hurd, and a couple of other people have really shown this. And my personal experience, and then also informal polls in my classes, this stuff is pretty effective. So what was your second question, Jerry? You had another one?
This is kind of off topic, although it related to, I think, the first conversation with Meredith. I've noticed over the months and years watching these programs that, and like even tonight, I'll go up to the top of the screen and see who's watching. And I've noticed that something like 70-80% of everyone who seems to participate, where you can identify if they're male or female, are females.
It's a classic demographic in this
business. I mean, in the Western culture,
Classic. Every program I do, that's the same. What you're saying here, I've heard this from countless people who work. It's my experience as well. I think, honestly, the opposite of patriarchy is matriarchy. I think this is a little bit of perhaps an indication of the sensitivity and, I would dare I say, the greater intelligence of the female species.
Oh, yeah.
They're more in tune with their bodies. They're more in tune with little things. They're not so caught up in kind of patriarchal enterprises and the like. I have to be a little careful with all this, as you can imagine. These kind of generalizations are ripe for sniping. But this is classic in my world. Every program, this is probably, I'd say, 60-70% female. It's great. I mean, it's wonderful. So women seem to be just a little bit more open, sensitive. Again, I have to be extremely careful making these kind of generalizations. But the data, at least informally in my world, is definitely supporting what you just said, for sure. I think that's because they're superior beings to us, Jerry.
Well, that's kind of supported in the scientific, you know, the psychological or neuroscience literature that, you know, they're, you know, because they take care of babies and stuff like that.
They're more in touch with their bodies, they're more in touch with the planet, right. They're more in touch with their emotions, they're less cerebral, they don't get blown away by logic and rationality. And,
right.
And just parenthetically, and then I'll let this go because I don't want to get in trouble, but in Tantra, the feminine reigns supreme. I mean, it's they actually talk about in Tantra, one of the characteristics is that it's the female that penetrates the male. And so that energy of wisdom is actually emphasized in kind of tantric ideologies. And so I'm just, again, like the earlier question, I'm going to tread somewhat cautiously here for obvious reasons, but I hear what you're saying. Okay,
thanks.
All right, I'm going to get these last two and then we're going to call it. So Luke and then Hannah. And then that will be enough for today.
Hi, Andrew. Thank you. And I guess this is just a really simple one. I was curious if there were any Tibetan formulas that have been specifically indicated by Menpas in the Tibetan medical tradition, specifically for lucid dreaming. I know that Bimala and Agar 35 are typically used for general, you could call mental health, but I'm just curious if you know if any Tibetan doctors have encouraged or suggested for general use Tibetan formulas. I'd be interested.
This is an absolutely perfect question for Dr. Nida. I don't know if you know who he is. I think I have him on both platforms, Nightclub and Edge of Mind. I've taught with him. He's amazing. He's a Tibetan physician. Teaches, one of the few people to teach with some regularity on dream yoga. He's written a book on it, and he is the perfect person to ask. You can get in contact with him through, it's called Pure Land Farms. It's in the Topanga Valley in LA. I can't remember the name of his main kind of assistant person there. But this is a question to ask directly to Dr. Nida. I'm sure there's something, but you know, it's interesting in the times that before I started teaching with him, we've done some things together. I took classes from him years ago and he's never mentioned them. So I would be a little surprised if there isn't something, but I don't know. In fact, it piques my interest, so I may reach out for my own edification and see if there's something. But I would start Nida Chetansang. I never know how to spell his last name. It's Chetansang or something like that. But Dr. Nida will get you, and if you listen to the podcast with him, look him up through his contacts. He lives mostly, I think, in Italy, but he does pop up in LA now and again. And he does work with the Pure Land Farms. You could probably get some communication to him. And
I'll ask. And I do know Christiana at Pure Land Farms.
It is. Christiana, thank you for reminding me. That's
yeah. I have studied with Dr. Nida. And I mean, my principal teacher, Chogyo Namkhai Norbu, had recommended Bimala and Agar 35, but not specifically for dream practice. And he was a real profound dreamer, as you may know. He did write an early book on dream yoga that was edited by Michael Katz. He mainly was talking about those two formulas for folks that had difficulty sleeping,
right?
But not necessarily for improving lucid dreaming or working towards, you know, doing more dream yoga practice. And I guess that's kind of where I'm curious, because I'm interested in the galantamine, and then I'm like, I should just try it, actually. I should just leave it at that.
I've had really good luck with it. So have you tried these agents yourself? I mean, have you tried the ones that you're talking about?
You know, I mean, for someone who has, like, I'm just going to speak in the, because I've been trained in Ayurveda, and it's a formula, like Bimala is a formula that was developed from Bimala Mitra, and it's better for folks who run high and lung, and perhaps Pekin, or in the Ayurvedic speak, in Vata and Kapha. If someone has a lot of Pitta in their constitution, Vimala might be too heating. So typically when I've seen Tibetan doctors, and they haven't prescribed it again for dreaming, They've indicated for me Agar 35. So that's the one that I've taken. And it just came to mind when Jerry was speaking. And then I was like, huh, I bet there's probably, you know, Mempas that have spoken more specifically. And I think you're right. Dr. Nita would be the person to ask.
Yeah, you know, I would definitely ask him. And on a slight interesting note, I've been in contact with Tony Bassas, who's the New York NYU researcher on psychedelics that he uses towards ends of life. And he sent me some really interesting papers, slight sidebar, about the use of psychedelic agents in classic Vajrayana and Tantra. I mean, stuff that I wasn't aware of. It's like really eye-opening and just really interesting literature search of how these agents were used going back. You'll find this in a bunch of other traditions. I was a little bit more aware of those. I wasn't aware of the tantric engagements with these agents, but the stuff is definitely there. And to me, it's like, hey, why not? I mean, body is just really gross mind. Mind is just really subtle body. And in Tantra, body is as important as mind. And you're working with what's called neurophenomenology. With every particular experience, as long as you're in a body, there's a neurological correlate. There's a neural signature. And so when you're working with these agents, you're working with very subtle body as a way to affect very subtle mind. And so they definitely have a place. And that's why some purists say, you shouldn't be using these agents. And I'm going, I think that's really limited. I think that's myopic. These agents have a place. And we all have different pharmacological, physiological signatures. And that's why galantamine really works for some people, does nothing for others. And this is where exploring and playing with these agents cautiously with the right intention, with some supervision, can actually be fruitful. So I'm a little bit more open-minded about this kind of thing.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Nice to hear from you. Okay, are we good for today? Yes, let's say yes. We all say yes. Hey, everybody, nice to see you. Those of you who are familiar with what we do here, we get together like this every 2 weeks, like I mentioned at the outset. If you're nightclub members, obviously we have 3 or 4 sometimes events going on every week. But outside of that, the usual propaganda I mentioned at the outset. Great to see everybody. If dedication of merit means anything to you in whatever capacity, whatever we have done here, we just send out for the benefit of all sentient beings so we don't think that we're special, that we're doing something elite. What we're doing here, if it's not of benefit to others and to the world, it's irrelevant. So we always have to remember that what we're doing here, yes, we can learn a few things, we can perhaps wake up, but we always wake up for the benefit of others. So let's never forget that. So we'll see you around the block, so to speak. See you back here in a couple of weeks. And we also do this kind of geeky fun thing where if you want, you can unmute yourself, turn your camera on, and we do this little cyber hug in space, just saying hi, bye. Nice
bye,
to see
bye.
You.
Bye.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
See you next time. Good to see you.
Good bye. To see you.